Listener, prepare yourself for a familiar voice in an unfamiliar setting.
I like beer, and I like cheese. I like the smell of a westerly breeze.
Recognise who that is? Well, we'll have more on that at the end of the episode when all will be explained. But for now, it's time to saddle up for another edition.
Hey, and away we go, through the grass, across the snow, big brown beastie.
I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Quiet, and do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not come
into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Monday, the 27th of April, and as we record this in the mid-afternoon, over 207,000 people have died in the COVID-19 pandemic. The number of confirmed cases stands at almost 3 million. Here in Ireland, there are over 19,000 confirmed cases, and the death toll, including probable and suspected cases, stands at 1,087. Now, we haven't had an episode since Friday. You may remember this from last week.
And then I see the disinfectant, where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it... there's a tremendous number of the lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
U.S. President Donald Trump there musing aloud about the possible role of disinfectant in combating COVID-19. Well, we're not going to go into that in detail today, or indeed the subsequent controversy, but our colleagues on the States of Mind podcast, that's Jackie Fox from the Foreign Desk, and our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan will be looking at that in a bit of detail. Elsewhere, the World Health Organization warned that getting COVID-19 and recovering from it isn't a barrier to getting it again. Here's the WHO's Michael Ryan.
Nobody is sure whether someone with antibodies is fully protected against having the disease or being exposed again. Plus, some of the tests have issues of sensitivity. They may give a false negative result.
It's also worth looking in brief at an interview done yesterday in which the issue of testing came up. Paul Reid, the HSE Director General, was asked about a newspaper report on letters he had sent to the Department of Health in which he expressed concern over the stated ambition of NPHET, the National Public Health Emergency Team, to increase the number of weekly tests to 100,000. Justin McCarthy asked him about this on yesterday's This Week programme.
Now, I want to get on to testing and that report in the Irish Times yesterday, which said that the HSE had raised concerns over the announcement on Friday by NPHET, that's the National Public Health Emergency Team, that testing should be ramped up to 100,000 people per week. What concerns did you have about that?
The concerns specifically in relation to testing related to how and when we get to a particular number of 100,000 or whatever number is required in the coming weeks and months. So it wasn't for us, and indeed my board, it wasn't an issue about what number it is, but what's the roadmap that gets us to deliver that. So over the past couple of weeks, we've been doing an intense piece of work to look at the end-to-end process from the time a person, a member of the public, contacts us to the time they get their test result. And we wanted to build up that capacity in the coming weeks. I'm very pleased to say now we have jointly with ourselves, the Department of Health officials and myself, or my own team, the HSE, have now a shared plan which will be going to Cabinet next week and gets us to 100,000 per week during the course, about the third week in May.
Okay, but how did you get from a point last week where you were writing letters to the Department of Health raising concerns about the capacity to scale up in that time frame to the point where today you're telling us that you can actually do it?
No, specifically, our concerns relate to two things. Number one, that the changing definition would commence from this week, which we wouldn't have been in a position to do. We couldn't scale up from current capacity to 100,000 per week from this week. That was one of our key concerns. The second one was just to work through that we did have a shared agreement about how and when we could scale up, and also that we will work through the changing case definitions to align with our scale-up plan. And that's what's actually what's part of our plan now that's gone forward. So we've addressed the concern around the timing, and we've addressed the concern around aligning the case definitions with capacity. They're primarily our two main concerns.
Okay.
Now, high levels of testing and contact tracing are regarded as a key part of a country's ability to significantly loosen restrictions or lockdowns. And we're going to look at some countries in the process of loosening those lockdowns in a moment with our Europe editor, Tony Connolly. We're going now, though, to our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
All right, Fergal, how are you today?
I'm good. It's the start of another week.
Can we start with what we heard just at the outset of this episode? Paul Reid was talking about testing and trying to move the testing capacity up to 100,000 tests a week. There was an exchange of letters there, which he described it as constructive tension between the HSE and NPHET. What do we know about this?
I mean, there clearly were tensions between the two, and the HSE is an independent body, and the department is its own separate body, but the department felt isn't the HSE, and the department is very much policy concerned. So I suppose there seemed to be difficulties with some pronouncements maybe out of the department that the HSE was wondering from a governance and a board point of view is, well, can we meet those targets? Do we have the funding for them? And, you know, we're the ones that will be required to deliver it. So our view has
been. So they were concerned possibly of over-promising again, because at the beginning it was anyone could have a test, and then they realised they wouldn't have the capacity to do that. They didn't want to find themselves in that situation again. Would that be broadly what the issue was?
Yes, I suppose, and the fear would be that if the HSE couldn't meet, say, for example, a target of 100,000 tests a week, then the HSE would be blamed for the failure to lift restrictions. So, you know, you can see how that would play in, because we're heading into another bank holiday weekend now, the May bank holiday weekend. The restrictions are due to expire tomorrow week, May 5th. But there are a whole range of factors that are needed to come into play, I suppose, for, you know, what we think might be a gentle lifting of some restrictions. And it's not all about testing capacity. So you'd need, for example, to see the number of confirmed cases reducing. Now, the rate of growth has been under about 5% for the last week or so. So that is positive. And then bear in mind that many of the new cases or cases we're hearing about are new or older cases that were coming through from the nursing home sector through the audit there. And that has to be factored into the numbers we were seeing, I think, last week. So you'd also like to see number of cases in nursing homes begin to reduce with the major interventions that are underway now. And on capacity, look, there's an agreed plan now between the HSE and the Department of Health, which I think is going to go to Cabinet tomorrow. That'll set out the sort of, you know, the model, the funding, the staffing to be able to do, if necessary, a capacity of about 100,000 tests a week. Now, at the moment, the HSE has capacity for about 10,000 tests a day. So it's not an enormous leap to go to 14,000 a day. But even if they don't get to 100,000 a week, that's not going to be something that would stop restrictions being lifted. That's important to say.
But so is the reagent aspect of things looked after? Because you think if you're going to ramp up to 100,000 tests a week, you know, if you have the lab capacity and the people there, that's one thing. But how long is your reagent going to last, and how secure is that supply line? If they are committing to that, they would be presumably confident that that's looked after.
At the moment, reagent doesn't seem to be a major issue, and it certainly wasn't raised yesterday at the HSE briefing. So these supplies obviously need to continue. And you'd also want to see that the numbers going into intensive care units stabilizing and reducing, because they'd be very, very important. And then also people would have to adhere to any relaxed restrictions so that the reinfection rate would stay below one. So, you know, there where the challenges are. And given that much of the challenge has recently been in nursing homes, might be that there'd be an argument to be made for nursing homes to be ring-fenced in terms of protection, so that visits and staffing would be very heavily controlled in nursing homes. Whereas if you look to the general community at the moment, the spread of the virus is relatively controlled at the moment.
Okay, well, let's have a look at nursing homes and community care settings. You've been speaking to a number of people in that sector, and they have concerns not only about the clusters and the infections, but other things too. What have they been saying to you broadly?
Yes, so we've 208 clusters or outbreaks in nursing homes, and then 114 in other residential settings. Now, HICWA, the Health Information and Quality Authority, it's doing inspections on homes, and in particular where there have been no outbreaks. So they're all being looked at the moment. But in long-term care facilities, there are particular challenges. And nursing homes, they are a special service, and you know, they are largely privately run with state assistance from the Fair Deal Nursing Homes scheme. And nursing homes, it's a nurse-led system. And historically, they have managed outbreaks before, and nothing like what we've seen at the moment. This is an unprecedented challenge for everybody. But they have managed flu-like outbreaks and deaths in homes. And during a very, very bad flu season, some homes I'd be aware of would have sadly seen deaths, maybe 9 or 10 deaths in a home. So they have the skill set to deal with these things. There is a large amount of stress in the nursing home, private nursing home sector, I'm hearing, particularly in relation to, you know, HICWA inspections and other pressures, I suppose. People may see that as red tape, although these are necessary systems. But on top of the stress or the physical stress of dealing with patients and trying to help family members, and also dealing with the emotional and other pressures of people dying, and the risk to oneself if you're going home to a household of people, it's very difficult. So there's a lot of anxiety. And also in some nursing homes, you would have residents who have dementia and other conditions. And because of the restrictions and difficulties that are happening now, maybe the daily stimulation for patients with dementia isn't possible. And that has consequences in terms of, you know, maintaining progress they've made. And nurses will tell you that it is sad to see if there's some difficulties there, that some patients just cannot, you know, enjoy the stimulation that they would have otherwise enjoyed.
Gathering in groups or talking to one another or taking, you know, what exercise they're able to take with supervision around the home, that's just not really a runner anymore.
It's not, and you know, you'll know from homes, there's activities, there's music, there's bingo, there's quizzes, there's lots of different activities that go on in homes, and these things are heavily restricted now, making the environment very challenging for the residents, for the staff who want to do the best, no doubt, and then also family members who have concerns.
Mental health settings, Fergal, is another area you've been having a look at today, and shortly before we began to record this podcast in the mid-afternoon, you got some new figures from the Mental Health Commission.
Yes, I was talking to the Mental Health Commission, and there's about 179 mental health facilities they'd be directly involved with. And they say now they have been informed of 12 deaths in mental health services. There have been 94 suspected or confirmed cases relating to residents, and 201 suspected or confirmed cases relating to staff. The Commission says it's doing everything it can to uphold the safety and the rights of and well-being of residents in mental health facilities. And there's 179, say, around the country. And that is a challenging sector, too, along with the disability sector, which we've heard about today, too, and then the nursing home sector. So there are particular sectors that require a lot of ongoing 24-hour attention.
Now, as we were discussing with Fergal, Ireland isn't expected to lift restrictions in any significant way anytime soon, but some countries in Europe endured horrific surges, and others which avoided high numbers of casualties are taking the first steps to emerging from their lockdowns. Let's go to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, who's been looking at what some of them have been doing.
Okay, Tony, thanks for joining us.
Good pleasure, Colm. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, we just wanted to look at countries that are beginning to ease restrictions today. We're not there yet in Ireland. So let's kick off where you're at the moment, in Belgium. How are things looking there?
Yeah, Belgium has had a very tough pandemic. 47,000 cases. I mean, this is a country of about 10 million. 47,000 cases, 7,000 deaths. So that's a pretty high figure. Now, they're much more generous here in counting care home deaths. So these deaths may be a more accurate reflection of the total mortality rate than perhaps what other countries have been admitting to. But last Friday, the National Security Council here had a very long meeting, lasted nearly the whole day, and they announced a series of staggered relaxations of the restrictions. So from the 4th of May, certain companies can reopen as long as they can maintain social distancing and have other conditions in place, sanitizer, masks and so on. Fabric shops can reopen. In particular, that's because they're trying to get the whole country to start wearing masks or some kind of face covering. Again, from May the 4th, outdoor sport without physical contact. And from May the 4th, face masks will be mandatory on public transport. So the whole country is going to get face masks for all the family delivered at their door. So then from May the 11th, all shops are going to reopen, again, according to strict conditions, but these haven't yet been announced. And from May the 18th, all schools are going to reopen, again, with conditions. My little fella Jack is in the maternelle, which is just kind of post-nursery. Unfortunately, he's not going to get back to school probably until June, so we'll have him at home for another while. Creches are closed until the end of May, so that means our youngest fella Felix is going to be home as well, so we'll have everybody at home until
fortunately or
May.
Unfortunately, depending on which way you look at it.
Well, of course, we're all delighted to have the little darlings around as we're trying to work, as you know. And then from June the 8th, there's going to be the gradual reopening of restaurants in Belgium, which of course, you know, Belgian food is a big deal, and it's a big mainstay of public life. And then bars will reopen later, but again, everybody's expecting bars to be last in the list to reopen. So from Belgium, we can take a quick scooch over to Italy. Again, the most prominent victim of the pandemic in Europe, 26,000 deaths. Now from May the 4th, they're going to be reopening certain industries and building sites, but schools are going to stay closed until September. People will be able to visit relatives in the same region from May the 4th. Some physical activity outside the house, outside home, even if you have to travel a bit from your home, you can do physical activity. I mean, they're talking about athletes and so on. A maximum of 15 people attending funerals. And then exporters can start as early as next week. Again, with certain conditions, the local authorities have to approve exporters starting to get active again. And of course, they'll have to introduce fairly strict safety measures again, masks, hand sanitizer, social distancing and so on. From May the 18th, sporting teams can start training again, and shops, museums, exhibitions and libraries can reopen from May the 18th. And obviously in a country like Italy, that's a huge employer when it comes to museums and exhibitions and so on. And from June the 1st, bars, restaurants, hairdressers can all reopen. Then we'll take a quick look at Spain. Of course, another very badly hit country. Huge moment yesterday when children in Spain were allowed out to play for the first time since the middle of March.
They were literally in lockdown in their houses, no going out, which
that's right
seems to have been the most restrictive, certainly of any of the countries we've been looking at over the last number of weeks.
Yeah, that's been a very, very tough time for Spain. And of course, as you know, Spain, you know, so much life and pleasure and leisure happens outside all hours of the day for kids. And well into the night, you know, before they get to bed, as you know, if you've ever been on holidays.
Pretty elastic.
It's pretty elastic. But Spain has already relaxed some sectors. Some building construction sites were allowed to reopen last week, and certain industries were allowed to reopen as well. But again, a big emphasis on testing and tracing and tracking, and face masks as well. So those are three countries worth touching on to begin with.
And all of them badly hit. And then there are other countries that weren't so badly hit because of very restrictive lockdowns from the beginning, or in other cases, a massive domestic capacity for testing. So the Czech Republic is one you wanted to have a look at the top of that list.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting case because it declared a state of emergency very, very quickly and brought in its own lockdown early in March, announced a state of emergency on March the 11th. They closed all schools and public gatherings were banned. So they really got in quickly and early. And as a result, they've had 7,000 cases and only 220 deaths. You know, relatively speaking, that's a very small number. It's understood the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK has been looking at the Czech Republic as a potential model for how to phase things in. Now, the government there had a 5-stage phasing in plan, but they've actually brought that forward because things seem to be going well. So already from the 20th of April, craft shops and car dealerships and farmers markets were reopened. Even earlier than that, in early April, people could cycle or jog or walk in the country without wearing face masks as long as they stayed 2 meters apart. From April 27th, smaller shops, outside shopping malls could open. Then larger shops, driving schools, fitness centres and so on. From May the 11th, museums, galleries and theatres could reopen. And from late May, early June, restaurants could open to serve customers outside. Also, hairdressers, beauty salons and shopping malls could open from late May, early June. And then finally, from June the 9th, bars and restaurants could fully open so they could serve people outdoors and indoors. And the same would go for hotels. So that's the Czech Republic. Germany, of course, they've had a fairly good epidemic in Germany, if I can put it like that. 150,000 cases altogether, but only 3.7% of those has ended in death. And I think the big advantage Germany had has been in testing and in the number of, ICU beds, intensive care unit beds that they had available.
They're almost an outlier in this. Their domestic biopharma sector is so massive, it dwarfs anything any other European country has in their capacity for testing as a result. It's almost not comparable with any other country.
Yeah, I mean, they have a huge pharma sector and they've been able to test 100,000 people a day. It's an unusual situation in Germany because you have 16 individual states who make their own decisions. So there's been a bit of a clash between the premiers of these states and Chancellor Merkel, who feels that some of these states have been rushing to resume normal life a little bit inordinately quickly. So there's a bit of tension there, although most people have been very supportive of the government's handling, of Angela Merkel's handling of the epidemic in Germany overall. But, some people in the individual Länder now are saying that things need to move a bit quicker. But indeed, smaller shops, car dealerships have been reopening. Some students have returned to schools. Even a few weeks ago, we could see that some football clubs like Bayern Munich were starting to train groups of five footballers training with, no physical contact and so on. But we are not yet at a state where there's a wholesale reopening of schools and shops being announced in Germany, but I think that's going to come quite soon. But again, the big advantage there is that they've been able to test people, meaning if you can stop an outbreak becoming a cluster and then stop a cluster becoming a full-blown problem. We can take a look finally, Colm, at Portugal. Portugal's an interesting case because they have been able to produce a huge number of face masks. They have a big textile sector there, and they've had a tough enough time. 24,000 confirmed cases, but 928 deaths. Actually, not that's quite a good performance if you look at next door in Spain, how many people have died there. But they are starting to reopen industry with conditions again: hand sanitizer, masks. And the government there have said that they'll take a step back if the situation worsens. Face masks obligatory in public schools, in schools and public transport. And again, a lot of municipalities in Portugal have been handing out masks free because they have that advantage. So a mixed picture. But you can see overall Europe is trying to get on a footing of starting to get things moving again, relaxing restrictions, but obviously terrified of a misstep that would cause another surge in infections that could indeed be worse than before.
And a return to the lockdown. All right. Thanks very much, Tony. Thanks for the roundup.
Good to see you. Good to hear from you, Colm.
I like beer and I like cheese.
I like the smell of a westerly breeze. But I like more than all of these to be on horseback.
Fergal, do you like cheese and do you like beer?
Well, you're referring to the project under the banner of COVIDAidIreland.ie, and that has involved a large number of people. This charity cover song, people got involved with this from all parts of Ireland, really, and in Canada, and indeed the Bahamas, with Mike Oldfield, who is the original song writer, along with words by the late William Murray. That song came out originally in 1975. What happened, Colin, was that about 4 weeks ago, I was talking to a very good pal of mine, Gary Grant. He's an Irish guy who lives and works in Toronto in Canada. And he's a composer and producer from the north side of Dublin. And he's been writing music for live shows and film and TV. And his mother, he was saying to me at the time, is in one of the vulnerable groups. And he wanted to help do something in Ireland, his homeland. So we were talking about it, and he suggested maybe there'd be a song or something, and I could help from the Irish end of things to try and pull it together. And so we looked at the idea of a charity song.
Why this song? I mean, you mentioned, are you the Mike Oldfield fan? Are you a fan of that particular album, Amadon, I think it's called?
I am, and Gary knew of it too, but I certainly am. I suppose we were looking for something that people wouldn't immediately be familiar with or remember. It's going back some time, but that would be sort of cross-generational. And it's, the words of the song seem to work particularly for this time. And so we've adults and we've children who are on it and are fabulous. We've got a beautiful singer, Gemma Goody, and Kyle Tyther, her musical partner. They sing in Dingle, and they're a great band.
Right.
And Age Action Ireland, then, and Irish Red Cross were the recipient charity, which we identified because they have a COVID-19 fund.
And to keep it with the horsey theme, Fergal, is this your first rodeo?
Well, yes. I've never been involved in anything like it before. It was a huge project, as I say. We got UniFlu sponsors to help the cost of putting it together. That allows all the money raised by the download to go to charity. And today, as of now, I looked a few minutes ago, it's number 4 in the Irish iTunes chart. And we're up there for a very short time, no doubt, with Hallowed Company of Jose and the Rolling Stones. So, you know, that's right. Thanks to people.
And Mike Oldfield's on board, is he?
Well, yes. Now, what happened was that to get permission to use the song from BMG, which are based in London and are Simon Cowell's organisation, effectively, we had to send the song cover to them, and they sent it to Mike Oldfield, who lives in the Bahamas. And he heard it, and apparently he liked it. And we got approval to do the cover. And Mike Oldfield retweeted on Facebook the link to the song over the weekend. And we've been getting communications from different parts of the world relating to it. So it is wonderful. And I mean, I think the kids are super on it. It's reimagined musically with Irish infusion to, you know, give it that Irish feel. And when you listen to the words, yeah, it's about freedom, getting outside in the air. Hopefully all of us will be able to do that again sometime soon.
If not on horseback, in some other way. So anyway, we won't do the usual intro today, Fergal. Why don't we just play it out for anyone who hasn't heard it? Here it is, On Horseback, featuring our own Fergal Bowers.
I like beer and I like cheese. I like the smell of a westerly breeze. But I like more than all of these to be on horseback.
Hey, and away we go through the grass, across the snow. Big brown beastie, big brown face. I'd rather be with you.
I like thunder and I like rain and open fires with roaring flames. But if the thunder is in my brain, I'd like to be on horseback. Some like the city, some the noise. Some make chaos and others toys. But if I was to have the choice, I'd rather be on horseback.
Across the snow, big brown beastie, big brown face.
Some find it strange to be here on this small planet with who knows where. But when it's strange and full of fear, it's nice to be on horseback. Some are short and others tall. Some hit their heads against the wall. But it doesn't really matter at all when you happen to be on horseback. So if you feel a little glum, to Hergis Ridge you should come. In summer, winter, rain or sun, it's good to be on horseback. I'd rather be on horseback.